Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 10th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. I'm anticipating a very stimulating program as our guest today is Helga Zepp LaRouche, and she always gives us fascinating insights into the twists and turns and the unfolding of current history. Joining us today as LaRouche Youth Movement panelists will be Petra Carlson from our LIM office in Berlin, and Megan Roulard from Boston. Helga, welcome back to the LaRouche Show.
Yeah, hello.
Well, much of the world is focused on the debate or non-debate on Iraq in the U.S. Senate. Lyndon LaRouche called our attention to a special insert in the February 3rd edition of The Economist titled Britannia Redux, a special report on Britain. In his address on Thursday to a diplomatic luncheon, he said the special insert amounted to a declaration of intent to revive the Anglo-Dutch imperial system, and that this is what should be the focus of any serious statecraft today. So, Helga, let's start with this. What are the implications of this Economist report?
Well, you know, for a long time, probably a lot of our readers worldwide where, you know, somehow saying, well, maybe LaRouche is brilliant on this and that, you know, scientific idea and economics and so forth. But doesn't he a little bit exaggerate the role of the British? But I think that what is the significance of this Economist insert is really that they brag, obviously for their own reasons, not only about the role of the British Empire historically, but they basically say, you know, that now the times of the, you know, where Great Britain was the sick man of Europe is over, and now London is the key financial center. Well, they don't mention it, but it's the key financial center in terms of the derivative and hedge fund and private equity frenzy. But basically, you know, they say very clearly that they want to reestablish the British Empire. And Lynn points to the fact that one completely misses the boat if people only look at what is going on around Iraq or even the threatened new war against Iran, that it is really globalization, that it is the effort by these London-centered sources, including their, you know, treason in America, junior partners in the Bush-Cheney administration, who want to establish a world empire. And that it is not Iraq, it is not Iran, but what is really at stake is the threat against Russia, against China, and against India. And I think this has been totally understood by the Russians, by the Chinese, and by the Indians. And one thing is very clear. If we do not get a change away from that policy inside the United States, I think we are heading straight to a global asymmetric warfare and World War III. And if Lyndon LaRouche needed some confirmation about that, I think it came today very, very strongly from Putin, who delivered a real bombshell at the annual Wehrkunde meeting. That's the annual most prestigious NATO and, you know, Western military meeting, which takes place once a year in Munich. And there Putin made a speech which really, I think, sent the chills down the bones of everybody who's not completely insane, because he made a speech where he said what the United States is trying to do is to try to establish world domination. They have crossed the borders in almost all areas. They are using an unbridled use of the military, and that NATO and the European Union impose their will on others. The fact that the East expansion of NATO and the European Union goes directly to the Russian borders is unacceptable, and so forth. So there was a complete freak out where, you know, basically For example, the NATO General Secretary Schäfer then answered and said that he was completely infuriated that this speech by Putin was not what was expected about the so-called partnership between Russia and NATO. This is a break. And why should Russia be concerned if the Rechtsstaat, if the state of law and democracy are moving closer to the Russian borders? Now, if you have ever heard a sophistry, then it's that, because, you know, it is the encirclement, which we had seen, you know, with the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, and similar developments in Central Asia, which since a long time convinced Russia that NATO and the European Union, without really any difference between them, are trying to, you know, basically target Russia and target the territorial integrity of Russia. So if Putin uses this forum, which is a world forum, and he didn't just speak to the members of this conference, but he wanted to send a big message to the world, and actually his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, commented afterwards, after some fury and upsetness occurred after the speech, he said this was a call for alarm, an alarm bell to wake up the world public. So, you know, I think that is really making it very clear that Lin was absolutely right when he said, well, you know, even if Russia, China, and India in the recent period have appeared to make concessions to globalization, deep in their national identity, they completely reject it. They insist on their national sovereignty. And, you know, Putin's speech in Munich, you know, is really going to be heard around the world as a rejection of the idea that Russia would submit to a world empire. Mm-hmm. Now, it should be also noted that similar moves are coming from both China and India. You know, China in the last week of January shot down one of its own satellites, probably using a laser-guided system to, you know, basically track the satellite and then using a normal rocket system to shoot it down. But as a clear demonstration that the idea, which was pronounced by the Bush administration last August, that they seek domination of space, is not going to be accepted by China, and also China made very clear they are not going to accept the continuous violation of international law. Now, the conflict with India may be a little bit less prominent, but I know from some of our very best contacts and friends in India that they completely refuse to be used as a geopolitical weapon against China. As a matter of fact, I think the Prime Minister Singh said this very clearly in an interview to Corriere della Sera, the Italian paper, a couple of days ago. So what you have right now, we are really heading for world conflict, where on the one side, the economist, you know, basically brags, here we are going to go for a British Empire again. And, you know, when I discussed this with Lin yesterday, he was saying that, no, it may be also a little bit that the British are so freaked out about the fact that the financial system is about to blow, and that the you know, the whole worry about new LTCMs, hedge funds blowing out, you know, that the whole indebtedness with which the hostile takeover merger mania of the last months has taken place is bringing the whole world situation to the absolute brink of a blowout. Not even talking about the collapse of the U.S. auto sector or the U.S. Real estate sector or similar problems. But we are sitting on a powder keg. And when at that point the British are saying, let's go back for an empire, it's as much to calm down their nerves and the nerves of their cronies in the hedge fund world and so forth as it is for anything else. But I think we should not underestimate the danger. If these forces, the old, you know, British, Anglo-Dutch, you know, financial powers who were the arch enemies of the American Revolution when it occurred and ever since, when they are trying to insist on world empire, and when at the same time it's very clear that Russia, China, and India are not going to submit, we are sitting on a powder keg which could lead to World War III in the short term. And I think that's what Lynn is emphasizing so much, that people shouldn't be just saying it's Bush or it's Cheney or it's just the United States and Iran. No, it's a much more complicated world picture. And I think, you know, people should not think in terms of daily developments, but people should think in terms of history and how these conflicts play out over the long term. And then it's more easy to understand when Lynn says that the old enemy of the United States is still the British Empire. And, you know, just because there are some treasonous elements in the United States right now, that doesn't change that analysis a bit.
Well, you're listening to Helga Zepp-LaRouche, our special guest today on The LaRouche Show. You can send email questions to Helga and the panel by sending them to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Helga, this is quite a picture you just presented, and I want to break down a couple of points in it to make sure our listeners are clear on some things. One of the things they hear all the time is that globalization is about computers, it's about the free flow of funds and information and ideas, and yet what Lyndon LaRouche keeps insisting is that the model for globalization is the revival of the medieval system of old stateless financial feudal kingdoms. So how is it that globalization does represent this revival of empire?
Well, I mean, you know that there is a tremendous effort by these hedge funds, by the financial powers, by the private equity funds, by the banks, by the fundi, the old family fortunes who are behind these, to basically say everything has to be privatized. The role of the state has to be scaled down. You know, we have to have public-private partnerships. We have to have basically private interest controlling everything. And, you know, if people just forget about the labels and look at the substance of the matter, the emergence of the nation state, which started to occur in the 15th century with the Italian Golden Renaissance, with the writings of the founder of the nation state, Nicolaus of Cusa, with the first French nation state under Louis the 11th, then, you know, basically for the first time, the principle was established that the government is responsible for the well-being of the people and that the government is only legitimate if it takes care of the common good. Now, the first time that principle was really established was with the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. Now, when the state, especially in times of crisis, is the only institution which can defend the interest of the people. And when you understand that that accomplishment took tremendous struggles to be accomplished, and that when you now see that with the privatization drive, you are dismantling, or there's an attempt to dismantle the function of the state, and everything is privatized again, well, then you go back indeed to feudalism, where private interest, and it doesn't really matter if it's today hedge funds or if it was feudal lords and barons and kings in the feudal time in the Middle Ages, but you go back to a situation where there is no check and balances to these private powers, and that what that leads to is a system, you know, where a few privileged, you know, forces. In the past, it used to be the nobility, the kings, the princes, and so forth, and their hangers onto power. And today, it's basically, you know, what some people like Lazare, Frères, Kornblum, and Rohatyn are calling the public, the global, I forgot how they call it, but they have the idea that the whole world should be run by the managers of these multinational firms, by the managers and CEOs of the hedge funds and private equity firms, and they should basically run the world. So what you are looking at is an attempt to, you know, completely eliminate the welfare of the masses. You eliminate the state as the protector of the normal people, and you give limitless power to a very few people who basically are more powerful than normal nation states, for sure, more powerful than small countries. And, you know, that's why Lynn put so much emphasis that it must be the really big nation states, the United States, Russia, China, and India, who should form a new alliance to curb the influence of these multinational forces.
And this is not a natural outgrowth of economic law, as you hear it asserted by the Viennese School or the Chicago School, but it's been a deliberate 40-year campaign going back to the mid-60s to destroy the state. That's what Mr. LaRouche is saying.
Yes.
Now, in this picture then, along with the attack on the nation state, there's an attack on culture. And I know you've written and spoken extensively, taught classes about this question. The attack on classical culture, in particular, the attack on German classical culture of Leibniz, of Kästner, of Moses Mendelssohn, and Schiller, that Germany has been a special target of attack by these oligarchical networks. So why is it so important to this Venetian, Anglo-Dutch crowd that they destroy classical culture, including the sciences and the arts?
Well, you know, it's really very, very clear once you start to engage in trying to perform and understand either classical culture, let it be in music, in, you know, the great music from Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, Schubert, Schumann. If you try to understand the composition and what the composers actually did, or if you do the same thing in, you know, great drama and poetry, if you read the, you know, dramas by Lessing or by Shakespeare or by Schiller, or, you know, you really start to understand how they compose. How do they discover poetical ideas? How does the classical form, you know, basically trains the mind to develop a poetical idea, to have a thorough composition of that idea, and then to conclude it on a necessary higher level, but you come to a conclusion. It is a way of thinking. Not only do you train your mind to again and again make discoveries in science and in music and in poetry and other great areas of culture, but you start to think in a sane way. Like, for example, when you have an idea, you develop it and you conclude it. But that's a sane way of thinking as compared to, for example, the, you know, romantic way or the telenovela way, where you have 100,000 series, or maybe only 5,000 series, and there's never an end. And there's always, it goes on, it's like an unconscious stream of conscience, and it doesn't go anywhere.
Talk shows. A stream of degeneration.
Yeah. Take normal talk shows where people are completely unable to stay with the subject. Somebody says, the tree is green today. And then says, oh, today I want to go and do shopping. Oh, there's a new shopping mall in my area. You know? So people, you know, are taking from each sentence one thing and then hop to the next. And it's a form of brainwashing because people are not trained to think something's true and come to a conclusion. And, you know, the population, a population which is not able to discover great universal principles of, you know, their own, you know, culture and great thinkers, but they are somehow blurred. You know, they read, if they read at all, they read textbooks, they read multiple choice answers. They don't go for the original thinkers. The whole universities are polluted with that. If you study medicine, you're not studying how the patient functions. You're studying, you know, what the HMO gives you as a multiple choice treatment according to a cost plan. I mean, it is so important to go back to the classics. Any Renaissance and any classical period in history, the humanists of that period always understood you have to go back to the sources. You have to restudy what were the great discoveries of these original thinkers and poets and scientists and composers, because only if you understand the method of making the discovery can you make a discovery into the future in a new area. And that is a lost art. That is really extremely important, you know, and therefore the attack on German classical culture is really an attack against Germany in more vicious ways than if it would be a military attack.
Well, before I bring our LIM panelists on, I wanted to ask you one more question. As a candidate in the past for Chancellor of Germany and someone who is a student in the real sense of German history, Germany has a crucial role to play in developing this Eurasian perspective, and yet at this point, the situation seems quite chaotic. What can you say about the political situation in Germany today?
Well, the main problem I see is that the German political parties have been so corrupted that there is presently, when the hedge funds or the locusts, as they're also called, are taking over Germany, they're just eating everything up. They are buying middle-level industries. They're trying to destroy large industries. Even on Siemens, there was just an attempt to take it over or dismantle it. They're buying housing. They're buying social housing. And they're just, you know, really, you have seen this with, you know, some of these like Lone Star and similar.
Well, it sounds like you're describing the United States.
Yes, I know. But, you know, what I'm trying to say is that there is presently, except of my party and the, you know, the civil rights movement Solidarity, which is the name of my party, there is no force which has any idea of defending German national interest against these locusts. For example, Merkel, who is the chancellor, last week gave a horrible speech in Frankfurt in front of the stock exchange meeting, where she said there will be no state orgy of re-regulation. Steinbrück now, there is a meeting of the G8 starting tomorrow in Essen, and they are really freaked out because they know this system is about to blow and people are talking about systemic risks and so forth, but they only talk about transparency. What does it do you any good if you even would know the figures of the hedge funds? What do you want to do about it? Then you have the young part of the SPD who completely made a coup against the former faction leader Müntefering, who had talked about locusts, and they want to invite the locusts now to invest in environmental industries in Germany. Then you have the Liberal Party, who are, you know, totally pro hedge fund. Anyway, what I'm saying is there is presently nobody except the BÜSO, civil rights movement Solidarity, which is defending this country against being completely sold out. And, you know, therefore, I think that the only hope, and that's what we are campaigning around here, is we are trying to get people to be prepared for changes coming from the Democratic Congress, in the hope that they will go for the FDR policy, you know, picking up on the proposals which my husband made, the Economic Recovery Act and the paper he wrote about the lost art of a capital budget. And we are telling people, look, when this crisis hits, from the United States will come a change in policy. And even if you think it's totally controlled right now, by the Anglo-Dutch, financial crowds, be prepared for a shock to come from the United States and be prepared to then form a partnership with the real America around the policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And that is the only way how we can get out of this crisis. And our opponents know that that is the biggest single threat to their designs.
We'll be telling you in a few minutes how to get some of these articles that Helga mentioned by Lyndon LaRouche. But we just have about 3 minutes before the break. And Helga, I might as well just follow up what you just said with this question. The institutions then have been corrupted. But individuals within the institutions, when you talk to them, when the youth encounter them, we do find that they have some sense of this crisis, don't they, in Germany?
Well, I think that the people here are starting to really quietly freak out because in the last week, I have noticed that people really understand that this massing of the Navy in the Gulf, that the U.S. is basically, threatening Iran, all the bellicose statements by Cheney, which were in the media here, and people realize that if Iran would be attacked, this would lead to, people just say, that's it, that's going to be it. So, people are aware that we are on the verge of World War III, because people in Europe did have two world wars, and they're not completely unaware of the connection of a financial crisis and a depression and war. So, I think that we do have responses both in Germany and France and Italy and other European countries, and the interest in the ideas of Lyndon LaRouche is indeed absolutely big.
And, of course, from the Berlin conferences, we've seen that there's very significant response from Russia and China.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I'd like to bring on the youth panel right now. Actually, there's just a little less than a minute, but Petra, why don't you give us a sense of what we're doing in Berlin, and I'll cut you off and we'll pick it up again after the break. But how are you today, Petra?
Yeah, I'm doing very good, thank you.
All right, you've listened to Helga talk about the institutional problems. I assume you experience that every time you go out in the street.
Yeah, and I actually just thought about what Helga said with the increase in global crisis and that people really start to get a sense of that. Because I can just take the example about the area in Berlin where we actually have the office, where you can see the last couple of months, the last 6 months, how increasingly there's much more homeless people on the streets. You see people every day looking into garbage cans, walking around, trying to pick up bottles. And I mean, we have also noticed around the book table that young people are really, really, really starting to get concerned about their future, that people sense that there's just nothing out there.
Petra, we'll have to come back to you because we have to take
okay.
a short break now.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live on the web every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And The LaRouche Show is also available in the past shows. We've had Mrs. LaRouche as a guest many times previously, and you can find that by going to LaRouchePub.com. And you'll see on the left-hand side, it says The LaRouche Show. You push that, and it will give you the archives, and you can bring up these past shows, as well as if you want your friends to hear this one. If they missed it today, they can always pick it up. If you're in the United States, you can call for literature. We have the most recent webcast, the January 11th webcast from Lyndon LaRouche, but also available are a series of writings on the capital budget, on the new Titanic in the political situation in the United States that just came out in this current EIR. You can call and get your copies at 800-929-7566. Call in and make sure you get the material, read it, get extra copies, and by all means also contribute so that we can print more because it's the work of the LaRouche Youth Movement and LaRouche PAC in the United States, which is going to bring about the kinds of changes we need in the Congress. So it's 800-929-7566. So we're back to the LaRouche Show, and I cut off Petra Carlson, who's talking to us from Berlin. You were talking about the responses from the youth in particular to the crisis that Helga described. Go ahead, Petra.
Yeah, right. That, I mean, we have definitely noticed with the organizing on the streets in Berlin the last couple of weeks, actually. But we also had a bus down to another part of Germany a week ago, and we were in Jena, the city where Schiller worked as a history professor and also was writing some of his dramas. That you can see that people are definitely worried. People see that there is no leadership, there's no direction, there is no one really taking responsibility right now. So we had a group of nine people going down with a bus and use the chorus work that we do in the office, working on Johann Sebastian Bach, Jesu meine Freude. And we started singing down in Jena in the city. It's not that big city. But after a couple of minutes, you had maybe 50, 60 people standing around in different parts of the squares, people opening the window. And you can tell that people, they can't really say what it is. They get curious, they stop, they listen, they respond to it. But it started just drawing more and more people up to the book tables. So after a while, we just had a sign which we basically said, sign up, leave your name and number and contacts right here, and we call you back. But to get back to the situation in Berlin, I think that we have the last couple of weeks taken a step forward with the music work together with the Kepler work, the science work we are doing. Because, of course, that we ourselves also sense that the rapid global ongoing changes right now is really getting to a countdown where things are going to be very, very decisive within a short period of time. So we are working on a new pamphlet here for Berlin that I hope will be ready within a week or so. And we have here the greatest organization ever in history. We have material, we have research. Linda LaRouche, together with Helga, with other people in the organization, have put material together, done a lot of research, and know what the problem is, know what the solutions are, and really what to do. And then you have discussions with, like, boomers at the book table presenting what we are doing, giving a clear idea that we know what to do, we know what the solutions are, we know what the crisis is all coming from. And then still you get the responses that, oh, that's nice, good luck to you. And you have just been standing and discussing that we are really, really close to a third world war. So, I mean, you see the insanity coming from the boomers that are just totally connected from reality right now. That you have discussions with them, and we were just talking here in the office the other day that sometimes you have the sense that you are the grown-up person that is trying to manage children to do the right thing, to do what is good, to somehow provide a direction for people that are in your parents' age, for people that you thought would provide you a future. When you grew up, I mean, you were thinking about your parents or older people as the ones taking more responsibility somehow, that they would take the responsibility to build up something for us for the future. But that's, you realize, is not really the case. And I think the responsibility on our shoulders right now is growing day by day. But I think the real excitement to also see how young people really, really develop fast and really grow with that.
Let me ask you a question on that, Petra, because I understand you've been working with some people in the war room from the LaRouche Youth Movement in the United States in putting together a picture of the networks that Helga was describing earlier that have attacked German culture and that are attacking classical culture today. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
I've been down in Leipzig setting up the local there. I've been there for 2 years after the Saxon campaign we had in Germany 3 years ago. And if you think historically about Leipzig and Saxon, the greatest networks, the greatest scientists, the greatest thinkers, the people that were mobilizing here in Europe for the ideas that the American Revolution was coming out from. And you see Leipzig today, how severely destroyed the city has been. And we set up a local there soon 3 years ago, and we're organizing. And it started out with some different small attacks around the book tables, around the office, the cars being smashed. There were different things that occurred that didn't seem to be maybe so big right then. But now, together with the discussions we have had with the war room lately that we just started a few weeks ago, that has been extremely, extremely good, useful, and also within the, I think, psychologically for the organizers here in Berlin, in Europe, in Germany, to have a much better sense of how these networks are operating, because we have had a lot of attacks going on around us for a long time, but have not really been able to trace how these things are working. We know, like in Leipzig, for example, that you have a youth place called Coney Island that has been, not directly, but it's part of the sponsored neocon network in Germany from United States that goes up via certain institutions in Berlin, that these young people came to our office a couple of times, but also came to the book tables and were smashing the pickets and kicking the table and so on. And trying to have a discussion with these people is not so easy. I mean, you have a lot of young people working within the networks in Antifa and Anti-Deutsch that are, I'm pretty sure, frustrated young people that want to do something, that see that something is needed, that but have just been so severely brainwashed into certain networks that are destroying Germany, destroying Europe, destroying our future more than it will ever contribute anything to build up anything. We had an intervention here in Berlin, it's just 4 or 5 days ago, with a Heinrich Böll Stiftung that had the president of FU, the Freie University here in Berlin, and he was going to give a speech. And there were a group of students from the university there. And when he was about to talk, they walked in, maybe 15 students, up on the podium. They had a megaphone with them and said that we're going to stop the professor from talking. We're going to block this meeting. We're going to block the seminar. And we are protesting against the privatization of the education, the fees that are rising. So in the beginning, we thought that, okay, here you have a bunch of young people that seem to be political that maybe we can discuss with. But then it turned out that they after the event, the whole intervention just turned into total chaos. People in the audience were standing up, started screaming. The students got louder and louder, and it turned into quite a violent atmosphere within a few minutes. So afterwards, when we came back to the office, we had a discussion about it and said that you have an increase of this, that there's demonstrations, there's frustration, there are a lot of young people on the streets, in the universities, but there's just no solutions. There are no ideas being discussed except what we are doing, except what the youth movement is doing in Berlin.
Let me just ask Helga to comment on this, because I know this is something, Helga, that you've been involved in fighting and trying to expose for many years. This is part of what we were talking about earlier in the attack on German classical culture. But how do you see this thing unfolding today, these kinds of deployments?
Well, you know, this is something which really emerged during the time of the German unification when the wall came down. I don't know if people in the United States remember that, you know, not everybody was happy about German unification. You had, for example, Margaret Thatcher and her terrible minister, Ridley, who started to launch the campaign that German unification meant that a fourth Reich was emerging. Which was totally ridiculous because, you know, this was the highest foreign policy principle of the free West, that German unification should occur. So where did this come from? Exactly from the same British Empire forces who basically for geopolitical reasons feared that a unified Germany would have a strong policy in respect to Russia and the East in general. So they started this campaign. Now, at that point, a group of students or young people emerged who called themselves anti-Deutsch. And they had the same line like Ridley, the minister of Margaret Thatcher, namely, you know, everything which is German is terrible, that everything which has to do with Israel is good, that you cannot attack any policy of Israel or you are anti-Semitic, that you cannot criticize anything coming from later from the Bush administration, and you are immediately anti-American, and you have to totally support the Iraq war, or else you are anti-American and anti-Semitic. So this group developed, and they became somewhat like an autonomous force. The police in Germany is very concerned about them because they have a very high potential of violence. So then, you know, we basically realized that they are doing exactly the same thing in the German universities, what you found out in the United States with such groups as ACTA and Ayn Rand Institute, mm-hmm. of people who have a kind of a thought control prohibiting any kind of a political discussion and immediately answering with goon attacks the moment somebody is trying to raise any important issue. So then we started to look, you know, what happens with these anti-Deutsch and anti-Antifa and groups, and we found out that there is a whole bunch of professors who are coming regularly from the United States to Germany and who are having seminars, training camps, you know, even week-long training sessions with strange, you know, purposes, and that these professors, some of them, you know, are sitting in Michigan, for example, a guy called Professor Markovich and some others, that they are then turning up exactly on the same level in the same organizations like the neocons. So then you look at it and you say, hey, wait a second, the Minister Ridley of Margaret Thatcher, the anti-Deutsch, anti-Fa groups, these professors and the neocons are all saying the same thing. You cannot criticize the Anglo-American war policy or else you are being called anti-Semitic or anti-German. Now, wait a second. This thing is not a coincidence. This is a very tight, organized apparatus. And, you know, we are going to publish this because I think it will be a big eye-opener for a lot of people who feel quite harassed and intimidated because, you know, you cannot say a word without being immediately attacked of being anti-American or anti-Semitic when you criticize Bush or, for example, when you criticize the Israeli war against Lebanon. And that's just totally absurd. So I think we have made quite some breakthroughs in uncovering these networks.
Well, that's really significant. I understand we have coming out in the next issue of the EIR, we'll probably have that initial phase of the story. And again, listeners can call in to 800-929-7566 to get that. Let me bring in our other LIM panelist. I hope she was patient enough to stay on the line. Megan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Now, I understand you're running into a slightly different kind of obstinacy from the academic types at Harvard and MIT, that you're going to them and asking them what they think of Johannes Kepler, and their eyes are bulging and their collars tighten and they start to sweat and rant and rave. What's been happening in Boston with the work that the LIM is doing to bring back real science?
Well, this is funny. Boston is a funny place because as LaRouche is reemphasizing, the enemy of the United States right now is our historic enemy. It is this British imperial influence, which you can trace back to Venice and even before that. So here we are, the LaRouche youth women in Boston, where this fight actually took place. And I think it is, you know, in Boston, which is also called the Athens of America. I think it's for this reason that what you find here on the universities is that there has been a special emphasis on attacking classical culture and the development of real ideas in the institutions here specifically. You know, one thing I would bring up is people are around the world are probably familiar with MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which if you go back to after World War II, LaRouche became particularly enraged with this institution because of the doctrine, the theory, information theory, basically the idea that the human mind is nothing but an abiotic process. And you can replicate all of its functions with a computer, which our youth movement knows is not actually the case because we're actually doing work on real scientific discoveries, specifically the work of Johannes Kepler. And recently our youth movement made a real breakthrough on, the work of Kepler has not actually been translated into English until very recently. So we actually have teams of young people. Most recently, there was a group who worked through, over a period of months, Kepler's Harmonies of the World and was able to demonstrate something that, you know, is pretty provocative, which goes against the idea of a, random, chaotic universe that you're living in where, you know, I know Helga's brought up, like, this idea of thrownness, where you're sort of thrown into this period of history. You know, there's not really any order. There's not really any way for you to intervene. And what these guys figured out and demonstrated and we're now circulating is that Kepler proved that the organization of the solar system itself was according to the harmonic principles that human beings use to compose music, that you, in a sense, had the sun conducting a chorus composed of the planets. I can't describe it all, but anyhow, we went around to some of the professors at MIT, talking to some of the students and letting them know about this breakthrough that we made after not, you know, none of us having any type of formal scientific education. And, you know, really created some freakouts. I can tell you one case in particular, where I called up a student, an old contact of mine who is doing some work nuclear physics. He's European, and I, you know, called him up and said, look, our youth movement is just, has made a breakthrough on this Harmonies of the World project. And he proceeded to get very defensive because he himself had never read anything that Kepler had written. He never read anything original of Kepler's. And, I mean, this is where you get into what Lynn is saying. This is the work of Paolo Sarpi, which says you'll give people like this student access to the formulas that are shadows of real discoveries, but you're not going to give them access to how the discoveries were made, because you don't want the general population to be able to willfully make discoveries. That type of population won't accept being controlled. And so this kid said, look, Kepler is important. It's important for somebody like me who has to apply it in the specific scientific work I'm doing. I have to know the formulas. But this is not something that is that the general population should have access to. In a sense, this belongs to the high priest. So what we are doing in terms of circulating amongst the scientific institutions here, the press release and access to the actual work that our youth movement has done, I think this is going to create some real freakouts.
And that press release is available on the LaRouchePact.com website on the Unity of Science and Music, I believe, isn't it, Megan?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would encourage our listeners to download it. Now, Helga, we have an email question to you from my old pal Spencer Cross, who's now in Boston working on doing some of the choral work there. And he said he's been reading the notebooks of Wilhelm Furtwängler, the great conductor, and looking at this question of how nations lose their soul. And he said, how can we show our respective populations the real legacy of our great nations, despite what they are currently seeing? I guess this is what we've been talking about, that when you start thinking that the United States is the United States of Bush and Cheney, then, or Germany is the Germany of Merkel, then you can see why people might be susceptible to anti-Deutsch or anti-Americanism. So how do we develop this sense of the real soul of a nation?
Well, I think the most important is that each of us makes the beauty of the great culture alive in terms of, that people have to, one after the other, study the mind and the work of people like Bach, Beethoven, Schubert. You have to learn to sing the songs in a beautiful voice. You have to sing the Bach motetten and kantaten, and you have to be able to recite the poetry of Keats or Shelley or Schiller, and there are many other poets in Germany, but I just like Schiller really the best. And once you do that and you somehow represent the Renaissance, which is in the minds and works of these people, and you are it, you represent it when you speak, when you communicate these ideas, then people all of a sudden see that this is a completely different universe. That when they talk to, especially young people who are not going to discourse, who are not going to, various rock concerts and so forth, but who are all of a sudden talking about, the discoveries of Kepler, of gravitation, of, how basically the solar system is organized and how you can use modern data from NASA to, basically amplify and confirm what Kepler was getting at. I mean, then they realize there are serious young people and serious old people. That's also sometimes a big shocker to find those. And, they represent a completely different culture. And it works. It has a wonderful effect on anybody who is not a complete moron or morally dead completely. And I think the more we are able to represent this culture and mediate the spark of creativity of more, creative periods like the Greek classic, the Italian Renaissance, the German classic, or the statecraft ideas of the American Revolution. Now, people get a sense that we are really a different species than those people who are the, you know, products of the paradigm of globalization. And I think that that's what we have to do. We have to become the sort of, you know, the radiating sons of creativity. We have to be the beacons of hope for people that there is another world there in which people can think creatively, and we have to be the example, because I think without us being the example, it does not work.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left. Megan, did you have a question for Helga?
Yeah, we have a sign that we've been organizing with here that says, I don't remember exactly what it says, but something about Bach and Kepler being our true founding fathers, which is, you know, it's interesting. You know, you get a lot of very perplexed glances from people. It's a good provoking sign to have in the field. But it's something that, you know, it really takes a, you have to really go through a historical, you know, type of lesson for people to even get them to think about what ideas created the United States. And I was wondering, in general, in the German population in general, what type of connection people have to somebody like Bach and Kepler.
Well, I think that there is a big difference between the eastern part and the western part of Germany, because in the west you had the Congress of Cultural Freedom, so-called, which was this tremendous, oligarchical cultural warfare operation conducted against the axiomatic basis which made the population susceptible in the United States for the ideas of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And, you know, the classical tradition in Germany and in Europe in general, which were seen as a potential, ally of Franklin D. Roosevelt's ideas, which was, for example, expressed in such tendencies as Adenauer and de Gaulle and so forth. So there was a tremendous warfare effort in the post-war period to eliminate the connection of the German population to these ideas. You had the combination of the Frankfurt School and the CCF, the Congress of Cultural Freedom, really conducting warfare by imposing the insane ideas of Adorno in terms of music, of Horkheimer and, similar people. There was a tremendous warfare, and therefore, in a certain sense, the connection to the classical period in the West is really severely weakened. You still have a lot of people who like Bach, who like choruses. That is still going on. But in a certain sense, it was much, much better in the former DDR, where this kind of cultural warfare did not take place, and the negative influence from the CCF only occurred after 89, after the unification. So therefore you find in the East still a lot of more resonance of people in Leipzig, in Jena, in Weimar, in such places, where people do still have a belief that this is German culture, Bach is belonging to them. And I think that we have a tremendous possibility to revive it, because even if the present, you know, generation of boomers and tweeners and also a large part of the youth culture have been affected by the cultural degeneracy of globalization, I also believe that, you know, a culture in a people is not something you can root out even in one or two generations. I think Lynn has made many times the point that if you look at the culture of a country, you have to go back at least 200 years of memory in the present generation, mediated through the grandparents and parents and so forth. And I think that's definitely one of the reasons why I do not absolutely give up hope concerning Germany, because, you know, I think that despite all the horrible things which happened in the 20th century, that, you know, the Germany was once the called the people of the poets and thinkers and inventors. And, you know, if you think of how many of the great minds did come from Germany, I think that we can re-evoke a pride in this great tradition, and especially, you know, in times like this where people really look for profound ideas.
Helga, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for your participation today, and on behalf of your many admirers in the United States, we hope to see you over on this side of the Atlantic during 2007, including in far-out locations like Houston and the West Coast. Petra, thank you very much. Megan, thank you. This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back with you next Saturday.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.